Okay, well, thanks for the invitation. It's always nice to be back in downtown Toronto. I'll be, when Greg asked me to talk about this, this was knotting in self-avoiding walks was what I'd been thinking about, and I said, well, if I have a good summer, I'll have some nice results, and otherwise I'll have some open questions. Well, turns out I've got open questions, although I think maybe the second one may be almost solved. I don't know yet. Maybe in a couple of weeks I may know. So you've already had an introduction to self-avoiding walks, and particularly the way I'll be doing it is very much combinatorial. So yesterday we heard talk about free probability. This talk will almost be probability free. Here's my introduction to the model. So we've seen self-avoiding walks. I'll be talking mainly about self-avoiding polygons. So just to remind you, when we count self-avoiding walks, we count the modulo translation. You can do this by fixing the origin. Self-avoiding polygons, it doesn't matter much, but I'm going to be counting them essentially as shapes. So modulo translation, and also I don't care where the origin is on this thing, where the initial point of the walk is, and I don't care whether you're going clockwise or counterclockwise. So for example, in two dimensions, the smallest self-avoiding polygon is four steps, and there's only one of them, namely this. And there are 2 6-step polygons, 7 8-step polygons, and 28 10-step polygons. This number, as we've seen, grows exponentially, and I want to just go through that argument again. Because it comes up in a few other forms. So this is the concatenation and subadditivity argument. For polygons, this result goes back to Hammersley and Keston in the early 60s. So if you look at Pn, the number of n-step polygons, I'm just taking n to be even here because P0 is zero, Pn is zero if n is odd, so just limit to n, even values. This limit exists, and the limit is the same as you get for all self-avoiding walks, which we'll call mu. This thing isn't long enough, I guess I have to use the... which button on the side? Really?
Fine, but it's right there.
Oh, camouflaged.
Yes.
I have to see what the light's on. Okay, so we'll call this number mu, which we'll be referring to. And the proof is a concatenation. If you have an n-step self-avoiding polygon and an m-step self-avoiding polygon, you can take the rightmost, uppermost edge of this one together with the leftmost, lowermost edge of the other one, put them together one unit distance apart, erase the 2 vertical bonds and join them with the 2 horizontal bonds, and you get an n plus m-step polygon. So hence the inequality this way. And once you have this inequality, then this means that the limit exists. The limit of the nth root, the n to the 1 over n exists, and in fact it's equal to the supremum of that sequence. This is a 2-dimensional picture, and it's essentially the same in 3 dimensions. The only difference is when you try to take 2 polygons and translate them, you might end up with edges that are not parallel. They may be pointing in different directions, so then you have to rotate one, and that's where... So then you get a constant factor coming in here, d minus 1. But that doesn't matter because you can just divide through, and again, you have a subadditivity relation. Okay, so... I want to spend a bit of time, a few minutes, just looking at the motivation for looking at self-avoiding walks. One, aside from the mathematical challenge, there are some places they come up in statistical mechanics in a few different ways, but in particular, they come up as models for polymer molecules. So here's one example, a sketch of a polymer molecule, polyethylene, and this is essentially a chain of carbon atoms. Each carbon has two hydrogens hanging off it, and this unit of carbon and two hydrogens is a monomer. And this monomer gets repeated many times. It's not 100,000 repetitions is not atypical for long polymers. And this is flexible, so they can have different conformations. And we want to understand what are the typical properties of these shapes. So topologically, a linear polymer is just modeled by a self-avoiding walk. One of these, you could have the ends attached to each other, and you get a ring polymer modeled by self-avoiding polygons. Some forms of DNA occur naturally in this as ring polymers. And then we have more complicated things with different kinds of polymers. You get branched polymers, can be modeled by lattice animals, and I'll talk about those right at the end. So, just my general slide on this. So the idea is that there's some flexibility. The bonds, a very loose approximation, you can model the bonds, the angles between bonds as steps of a random walk, maybe with some finite memory. And that takes you only so far, because then you get into the excluded volume problem. Random walks can revisit the same point, but you can't have two monomers occupying the same position in space. So the simplest model that reflects this constraint is the self-avoiding walk model. It's a rather crude one. It's on the lattice and so on. But it's actually a pretty good model in the sense it's believed to have the same scaling limits and critical exponents as a linear polymer under two conditions, that it's in dilute solution, so you don't have to worry about polymers, two different polymers bumping into each other, and also in a good solvent. So this screens out electrostatic interactions between two different monomers. Otherwise, they may attract each other and collapse into a ball. So under these conditions, you get the uniform distribution on all self-avoiding walks is a reasonable model. And this has certainly been well studied in the physics and chemistry literature by two Nobel laureates, Paul Florey and Pierre-Gilles Dejean, and Dejean's picture is also up here on the wall as one of the former speakers at Field. So polymers and knots. This is of interest for a few different reasons. DNA, this has received a lot of attention recently. You have this long strand of DNA. Normally, it's all coiled up nicely, and then it's time for the cell to divide. It has to open up and replicate. Well, sometimes it gets tangled up, and this is bad news for trying to separate strands. So there are these little enzymes, topoisomerases, that run around, and they actually know how to untie knots. They take two strands that are stuck together, and they're able to break one through the other, and then patch up the place where it's gone through. And somehow they're able to do this more intelligently than just randomly. And they're not theorists who study knots that occur in DNA and try to infer these mechanisms. Also in manufacturing, if you're doing manufacturing with polymers, knots can lead to defects in the materials that you're making, so there's interest there. But also, maybe at a more pure science level, there's the potential for novel physical properties when you have knots or linking behavior in polymers, maybe new properties of viscosity or elasticity or other things. So people are actually paying some attention to trying to synthesize interesting polymers with different knotting properties. So there's a book that I was looking through, Molecular Catenanes, Rotaxanes, and Knots, and a journey through the world of molecular topology. And a lot of this is progress in trying to synthesize different kinds of molecules. So the first success was in 1960 when they were able to actually make a simple link of two polymers. 1989 was the first knot where they could do a trefoil, and then the same people a year later did this four-crossing knot. Links, they've done a little bit more. They've been able to do five links together in this particular configuration of seven links together. So these are all controlled reactions where step by step it's all planned out. And this one's interesting, the boromine rings. So these are three rings. No two of those rings are linked topologically to the other, but when you put all three of them together, they're linked. Okay, in future they're trying to do things like generate as many of these polycat names, so lots of these links together, or maybe what they call an Olympic ring network, with sort of a giant chainmail, lots of links put together, and what does that, what kind of properties will that have? They don't know really, and a few others. So this is an active area of chemical research. So, with that excuse, I go on to looking at knots in self-avoiding walks. So I'm going to look at knots, particular knot types. So PN was for polygons. When I write PN of K, that's the number of n-step self-avoiding polygons in Z3 now. Now we're only talking in three dimensions, of particular knot type K. So a useful inequality, again, comes from catenation. If you have one polygon, an n-step polygon of knot type K1, and another m-step polygon of knot type K2, and you concatenate them as we did before, then you get an n plus m-step polygon, and now the knot type is the composition of K1 and K2. What you get when you, the compound knot, K1 combined with K2. And there may be a constant factor here for rotation and so on, but I'm not going to worry about constant factors because it doesn't make a difference at the level we're doing it. In particular, if you take both of these to be the unknot, so zero, so this is a self-avoiding polygon that's just the simplest knot. You can deform it into a circle. Then you get that the number of unknots, n-step unknots times m-step unknots is less than or equal to n plus m-step unknots. So this means that there's a limit for this thing, that there's a well-defined exponential growth rate for unknots. And in fact, mu naught is less than mu by Keston's pattern theorem. So let me take a sidestep to explain about this pattern theorem. So this was this is a result that Keston needed for something else about self-avoiding walks 40 years ago. And the idea is quite natural. It's sort of a law of large numbers flavor, or large deviations flavor even, for a probabilist. So a pattern here is a particular sequence of steps, like a very short self-avoiding walk. For instance, here's four steps. We're looking, how often does this sequence of four steps appear on a 10,000 step self-avoiding walk, or self-avoiding polygon? And the point is, if you have a pattern that doesn't make dead ends, so if it can appear several times on long self-avoiding walks, then it does appear very often. In fact, for some epsilon, it appears at least epsilon n times on all but exponentially few n-step self-avoiding walks. So in particular, if I take this pattern to be the following, which is a really a knot pattern, what we call this a tight knot in the sense that if this occurs on part of a long self-avoiding walk, then it's impossible for the walk later end to come back and thread its way through because the lattice space, there's no room in the lattice. So if this pattern appears, then already what you have is some kind of knot. It's not the unknot. And what this says in that on most very long walks, this is going to appear very many times. So most very long self-avoiding walks are fairly complicated knots. The minimal crossing number, if you want to measure it that way, the complexity of the knot grows in proportion, at least in proportion, to the number of steps in the walk. And in particular, if you look at unknots, things with no knots at all, this is exponentially rare. And if you think about, and another way of saying that is that the exponential growth rate is strictly smaller for unknots than for all walks and polygons. This also says the same thing for every fixed knot type K. So if you look at the trefoil, for instance, the simplest knot, well, those are also going to be rare because, again, this is exponentially smaller. A very long trefoil is rare because it doesn't have lots of these little tight knots sticking around it. So the growth constant for the trefoil should be strictly less than mu. Now I put brackets, sort of quotation marks around here, because I haven't proven that this exists for anything except the unknot. And in fact, that is the first open problem here, which I didn't show you at the bottom of this slide, is to read backwards, is to prove that for any particular knot k, that this limit exists, that you do have an exponential, well-defined exponential growth rate. And moreover, what's reasonable is that the for any particular knot, it should have the same exponential growth rate as the unknot. And you can think about this, I guess, looking at it locally. If you have a million-step self-avoiding polygon, which is an unknot, and a million-step self-avoiding polygon, which is a trefoil, and you look at a thousand steps, a piece of a thousand steps out of that, you're not going to be able to tell which one you are. Somewhere in here, there's a single knot. It may be a large-scale knot, and it may be one small-scale knot somewhere, but these things are going to look very much alike. So, anyway, that's the best argument there is for doing this. I should mention that people have tried studying this by simulation. This is consistent with simulation results, but it's hard to tell because these things are extremely close. They're off by, I don't know, they're less than 1% difference between them. It's a little delicate doing these. You can... Yes. No. People have. Let's say it's consistent with. It's not easy to do. If you're simulating walks, self-avoiding polygons of 10,000 steps, you don't see very complicated knots. You certainly don't see evidence for Keston's pattern theorem, although we know it's true. At least not for, because these patterns already are, the ones with local knots are already fairly long. Okay, so what we do know about this this problem Okay, so if we don't know the limit exists, so we define the lim sup mu overline and the lim inf mu underline. Well, again, as I said, the pattern theorem gives us this strict inequality compared to all self-avoiding walks. And we at least have this inequality. So unknot is a lower bound for other knots. And that comes from the inequality that we had before. If you take a small knot of type K, attach it to an unknot, and you still get a large knot of type K. So now take the 1 over m root, fix n, let m go to infinity, this thing goes away, you just get mu 0 less than or equal to mu k. Well, mu underline k. So how might we try to do this? This is where I get stuck. The sort of thing you'd like to be able to do is transform some n-step n-step knot into an unknot. So, for instance, a trefoil, what might you have to do? Well, you'd be allowed to add steps. Maybe you'd like to have this thing pass through the other, so you can add some steps to go around, but you can't add too many. The number of steps you add has to be little o of n. And since rigorously, well, first of all, you don't even know for knots that such a crossing exists. It could be a big trefoil and a huge tangle, and there are examples where there's no single strand crossing on a particular projection that lets you do this. So anyway, it starts to turn into more of a topological problem, as well as a geometric and combinatorial one. The other angle through this is through something called unknotted bridges, where we can at least do a relation here. I will explain this now. So if you back when I was talking about what does an unknot look like locally, well, locally it's atypical of a a long unknotted self-avoiding polygon. It doesn't look like a typical self-avoiding walk because of Keston's pattern theorem. But you might think of it as, you might try to understand what pieces of that look like nevertheless. You can't really talk about unknotted self-avoiding walks because the ends are free and it's really only closed curves that have well-defined knots. But, well, you can almost do it. There are these class of walks, self-avoiding walks, called bridges. Essentially, they go from one plane, they start on one plane, they end on another plane, and everything stays in between those two. So here's an n-step bridge of span L. L is the distance between the planes, but I don't care what the distance between the planes is, so I'll just take bn to be the number of n-step bridges of any span. And nice thing about bridges is, again, you take two bridges, stick them together, you have another bridge. So we have our subadditive inequality again. So the limit, there's an exponential growth rate, and in fact, it's the same as for ordinary polygons and walks. It's the same number mu again. So we can talk about what we mean by an unknotted bridge. So if you have a self-avoiding, if you have a bridge, and if you join the ends, you go way outside and join them far away, since these things are sort of on the outside of the walk, and if this makes an unknot, then we say that the bridge is unknotted. So again, I'll define the number of unknotted bridges by bn of 0, and concatenation tells me that this has a growth rate, which I'll write as mu superscript b of 0, of the unknot. Again, the pattern theorem tells me it's strictly less than mu. And in this case, so we want to relate this to mu for the unknot in polygons, and that we can show that they're the same. So I'll just... we can prove that mu for bridges, unknotted bridges, is the same as mu for unknotted polygons. So I'll throw this p in here just for clarity. I'll just say a word about the pictures behind this, but first I thought it's almost more instructive to show you the proof that doesn't work. So here's the proof. Let's say I wanted to show that there are fewer unknotted polygons than unknotted bridges. So here's the first thing that you might think of. Unknotted polygon, so look at the extreme left and extreme right points, clip it there, and then take the top part, top curve, which is the red one, reflect the red curve through this vertical line, and there you go, you got an unknotted bridge. Okay, well, that looks good, but it doesn't work. You certainly get a bridge, but you may not get an unknot. So here's an example. Here's an unknotted polygon. So it's a rubber band that you've put into a loose knot, and when you do this, the red comes out and it leaves behind, the brown half is a knot and the red half is another knot. So sort of drove home to me that it's not easy life being a knot theorist. But okay. So I'll just put up these pictures here. To show that there are more unknotted bridges than unknotted polygons, you can fix. So the idea is we can take lots of little polygons and put them together and sort of stack them up in some large strip. And when we concatenate them, this will be a bridge. It's a bridge that goes here and then goes way up out of its way and comes back. But basically, it's made up of lots of polygons. And essentially, you're using polygons to make up bridges. I won't go through the algebra, but you get this, you get the right inequality. And similarly, you can make bridges out of polygons by forcing your bridges to lie in tubes. This reduces the mu for bridges, but it doesn't reduce it by much, and by taking the width of the tube large enough, you can get it as close, in the limit, you get back this quantity, the mu for all bridges. And this will also let you construct, say, a trefoil in this picture. So this also shows that you not only local knots don't tell the whole story, you can also get global knots with at least mu b of 0. Okay, so I just want to go on to the last problem, which is about linking. So far it's been about knots, but this problem Well, a week ago it was open. Now I'm not sure. So here we're thinking about branched polymers. So this time we're looking at lattice animals. So a traditional lattice animal is what you may know it as a percolation cluster. It's a connected, finite connected subgraph, say of ZD, with exactly n sites. And we count these things modulo translation. Well, here's some numbers, and once again, you can concatenate two animals, put them side by side, join them with an extra bond, and you get another one, so you have this inequality, so you get this exponential growth rate. The catch here, it was obvious for self-avoiding walks, is that this thing may be infinite. The subadditivity theorem doesn't guarantee that for this case, the exponential growth rate is finite. Maybe the nth root of this is infinite. You have to think a bit to do this for lattice animals, but there are some. It's been known for a long time that, in fact, the growth rate is finite. But you can ask the same thing, motivated by those Olympic ring networks and so on that chemists are trying to concatenate, also by entanglement percolation. So this real question really came from Jeffrey Grimmett. You can look at linked clusters, a finite subgraph of Z3, which is not connected, but the components are topologically linked together. So this one has three components, if you can see how I've drawn it. And they're like those catenanes that I showed before. So let Ln be the number of these, with n sites modulo translation, allowing any number of components and any kind of complexity of knots. Again, you have this concatenation and this exponential growth rate. Okay, let me skip through here. So the number of links, in fact, has to be strictly bigger than the number of animals. So there's another kind of pattern theorem that shows that. But the real question is this lambda for linked animals finite? And I've been sort of looking at this off and on for a while, I think I know what to do, but I've thought this before, so if you come back to me in a couple of weeks, it may still be open. But rather than show you the idea, again, I want to show you a similar problem just to show you why it's hard. So we can define something totally different. So think about trapped clusters. I'll draw the pictures in Z2. So this is what I call a trapped cluster. It's a finite graph, and some of these, this component, for instance, is locked inside the other component. So the pieces are rigid. If you tried moving this component, it can't get out. It's trapped in the cage. And similar, these other pieces. So if you say, how many of these subgraphs can you make, how many of these trapped clusters can you make with n edges? With n sites. Call that Tn, and it turns out that this doesn't have a finite exponential growth rate. You have subadditivity, but it goes to infinity. And here's the example that shows it. You can take n sites, put half of them in the perimeter of order n, that gives you area of order n squared, and then take the rest and make tiny little components out of them. So you have order n components. And those can go anywhere inside this area. So the number of trapped components is at least is like n squared choose n, which is grows roughly like n to the n. So if you're going to solve the problem with linked clusters, you have to do something more than this sort of thing doesn't work. You really have to somehow look at what it means to be topologically linked. And it gets complicated once you go down many layers. For something like the Olympic ring networks, where it's just a bunch of simple links, I know how to prove this, but the problem is when you have necklaces, a bunch of links making a necklace, and then those necklaces link with other necklaces, and then those necklaces of necklaces link, and then you could go down log n layers, and that's where you lose handle of it. So these are a couple of interesting problems, and there was at least some probability in there, so hope you found it interesting.